She was really sweet, y'all. I thought she was going to tell you that I got over there, and being the typical alcoholic that I am, I did not have any money with me. So here immediately after just knowing her a few short hours, I had to borrow money, you know. So I thought maybe she's going to get up here and say, I learned she's a moocher. You know, I hope I've grown a little bit, though. Hello, everybody. My name's Billy Strasser, and I am an alcoholic. It's great to be here. I have had an absolutely wonderful time. It's a beautiful place up here. The fellowship has just been marvelous, and I have met some wonderful new friends. And George especially, I have to tell y'all this before I start my story. Thursday evening, I had been looking at him, and you know, I thought, I know this man from somewhere. And I found out later he had been looking at me too. But you know, I'm a sober alcoholic now. I can't go up to him in front of his wife and say, don't I know you from somewhere, when I couldn't remember from where. Well, anyway, I didn't have to do that. He came up to me and we realized that we were delegates together in New York in 95. I was a panel 44 and he was a panel 45. And that's where we knew each other from. And whew, that was a relief. And Joe and Diana, oh, they're just great. And I thoroughly enjoyed Diana's talk. I could really identify with her childhood. And I could identify with Joe. And, you know, he said last night he was going to talk 2 hours. And he didn't, so he said he would give me his extra hour this morning, so y'all just lock in. We're going to have a good time. Halfway through my story this morning, you're going to wonder, she's a spiritual speaker? And I wonder that myself, but we're going to see where God takes us this morning. As I said, my name's Billy, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. My home group is the Coles Point group out at Sardis Lake. It's just down the road from where we live, so it's very, very convenient. And if you can't say your home group's the best home group in the country, then you need to get another one, because mine's the best. And one of the nicest things about it is that my husband's in the program, and he keeps me honest in these meetings. You know, I can't get away with anything. So it helps to have a spouse that's in the program. I also want to begin with my sobriety date. It's February the 14th, 1986. No, excuse me, 85. Forgot about that. All right, that was a pretty good start. When I was born, and don't all of y'all say, oh God, she's going to start when she was born. But when I was born, my mother had carried me for the 9 months, and my mother had already crossed the line into alcoholism. And when she gave birth to me, I always say that I came into this world already primed and pickled. I had the alcoholic personality and isms from my earliest remembrances, and I didn't know what it all meant. When I was 2 years old, my father left my mother because he could no longer stand her drinking, and my mother went home to my grandmother. Now, y'all, my grandmother was this short little lady. She was shorter than me, believe it or not. And she had come to this country from Sicily. So I was raised in a very strict, old country, Catholic family. I did not get to do the things that the other kids got to do that were my age. I didn't get to spend the night with other children because my grandmother thought their house might burn down. You know, and I didn't get to do this or that and the other because she had this large responsibility of raising me. I was 2 1/2, and my mother met this man who was also a budding alcoholic. They knew each other 2 weeks, ran off and got married, moved to Paris, Illinois, and that was that. She left me with my grandmother. They would come and get me during the summer and take me to Illinois to visit with them. And then in the fall, they would bring me back to Mississippi, Leland, Mississippi, back to my grandmother. And you know, as a young child, I couldn't understand why I didn't live with my mother and why I didn't know my daddy. And I later found out that my mother and her husband were very, very bad alcoholics. But you know what? It didn't bother me. I didn't care. I loved my mother, and I wanted to live with her. So every time they would ship me off to Illinois, I would say, "Mama, please let me stay with you." And she already had another family by then. And she'd say, "No, you've got to go back to your grandmother." And I kept wondering, is something wrong with me? And as a child, I only remember seeing my father one time. And he came to visit me, and I was afraid of this man because I didn't know him. And he left going back to Georgia. He lived in Millen, Georgia. And when he left me, he never said goodbye. And it broke my heart because I thought my daddy didn't love me either. When I was in the 7th grade, my mother finally agreed that I could live with her. So we got all of my records from the school and got me registered in the school in Paris, Illinois. And during this period in their lives, we were woken up like at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and my stepdad would throw us in the car going and looking for my mother. Or my mother would throw us in the car going and looking for my stepfather. There was always one of them drunk. They didn't seem to do it at the same time for some reason. I never understood that. But one of them was always looking for the other because they were periodic drunks. They were not daily drunks. And see, I didn't care about all that. I just knew I wanted to live with my mother. I wanted to belong somewhere. The Sunday before I was supposed to start school on Monday, my mother came to me and she says, "I'm sorry, but you can't stay. You've got to go back. Your grandmother will die without you." And they shipped me back home. And I thought then, what's wrong with me? Why doesn't anybody love me? And I made up my mind then and there that I would never, ever love anybody. That I would never, ever trust anybody. And that you would never know what I was feeling inside. So I began playing all these games and these roles. And you looked at me and you thought I was always a well-put-together kid. And I was this whirlwind tornado just ripping through people's lives, just making destruction everywhere I touched because I didn't care. By God, you were going to be as miserable as I was. And life rocked on. I also said I would never be like my mother. I would never be an alcoholic. Boy, how many of us have said that? Oh. But when I was a junior in high school, a bunch of us girls went out one night and we started drinking malt beer. Country Club malt beer. Do any of y'all remember those? The little bitty short cans. Well, that was my first experience. I drank, oh goodness, I don't know how many of them, but let me tell you what, I was so sick that I thought I will never, ever drink another can of beer as long as I live, and I didn't. But very shortly after that, I found Old Charter. Y'all, Old Charter did for me what it's supposed to do. I drank Old Charter, and I didn't even like the taste of it, y'all. I had to force myself to drink it. But you see, I liked what it did for me. And when I drank Old Charter, everything was okay. You know, Diana was talking about being tall. Well, the tallest person in my family is 5'4". You know, Italians are a little bitty short, squatty people. And I wanted to be tall and slender and beautiful. And when I drank, I felt tall, slender, and beautiful. I felt love when I was drinking. I felt warm and fuzzy, you know. And it was wonderful. But, you know, I just ran over people. And when I was 14 years old, I met the man that I later married. He was 7.5 years older than I was, Bobby. And the only reason, and I'm sorry to say this, but the only reason I married him was to get away from home, and because he was the only person that I had met in my short life so far that stood up to me and that I couldn't run over. He actually had the guts to stand up to me, and nobody else had. And when I graduated from high school, I was 17 years old, and I married this man. And I guess I loved him as much as I was capable of loving him. Because you see, I really didn't know what love was. But I knew I had this plan, and it was that I was going to get married, and I was going to have this huge family. I was going to have about 5, 6, 7, 8 children. And everything was going to be wonderful, and I was going to love them, and they were going to love me, and I was going to live happily ever after. And it would take care of all those things that I had done as a child, and all the hurt and everything. Well, it didn't happen. You know, all through school, I felt like I was this round peg trying to fit in a square hole, and it just didn't work. I never truly fit. I acted like I did. I was so full of paradoxes. You know, I made you think I had the world by the tail, and I didn't. What you saw and what I was two entirely different people. So Bobby and I got married, and we loved to party. And we did. We partied every weekend. I couldn't wait for Fridays to come because I got to drink Old Charter. Do you know that when you're from Mississippi and you go up north and you ask for a bottle of Old Charter, they ask you if you're from Mississippi? Did y'all know that? Well, people do. They know immediately where you're from. And I had a little girl, beautiful little girl. She looked just like her daddy. And I held this baby in my arm, and I didn't know what to do with her. I had not been around children growing up. I did not know what you did with a baby. I didn't know how to love her. I knew absolutely nothing. So I kept looking for answers. What's wrong with me? And I started this long search echoing to you these wonderful psychiatrists. Do y'all realize that you can manipulate a psychiatrist any way you want to? They are not worth a flip. You know, I mean, all they have to go by is what you tell them. You know, am I going to sit there and tell this psychiatrist I drink? No. I'm having fun. Beside that, alcohol was not a problem. Although I lived for Friday, and I started getting depressed on Sunday because I knew I had to start tapering off to be able to go to work on Monday. And then the cycle continued, waiting for Friday. Well, the psychiatrist didn't know what was wrong with me. And they said, oh, this stems back to your mother and dad and your childhood and all. And I thought, well, you know, that has something to do with it too. But something else was wrong, because I was just never comfortable anywhere. I wasn't comfortable in my own skin, and I had absolutely no idea who Billy was. Because when I would see a person and I liked the way they acted, I mimicked them. I became that person. I started talking like them and acting like them, to the point that I didn't know who I was. And life rocked on, and things just did not get any better. And my husband didn't understand. He never understood me. He just knew that I was crazy. After a while, we moved to Greenville, had a brand new home. It was beautiful out there. Had two cars, you know. Everything was going along great. And there was this wonderful German couple that lived right next door to us. And believe me, y'all, Germans love to drink. They drank every day. And it gave me an excuse to go to their house every afternoon when I got home and have a few drinks before I went home to start cooking. And the more I drank, the more I became paranoid and the more depression set in. And in the meantime, shortly after I'd married, I got to learn everything about my father. And I found out from him one night at midnight. We were sitting at the kitchen table in Georgia, and he looked at me and he grabbed me by the shoulders and he said, I am so sick and tired of seeing this look of utter hatred on your face. And I said, Daddy, why didn't you love me? And he said, I did. He said, I wrote you many, many letters. I never got them. I called you many, many times, and I never got the phone calls. And I said, you didn't tell me goodbye when you left when I was so little. And he said, they wouldn't let me. And I didn't know this, that my grandmother and my aunt, her sister and her husband that lived with the house with us, had kept all this from me because they did not want my daddy to come get me and take me back with him. Well, anyway, my daddy and I began a beautiful, beautiful relationship. I loved that man with every fiber of my being, as much as I was capable of loving another human being. And my daddy was also an alcoholic. He was a late-blooming alcoholic. My daddy was an attorney, later became a Georgia state judge. So I'm in Greenville, and I'm at my wit's ends, and I didn't know what to do. I wanted to leave my husband. I wanted to leave this child. I didn't care. I just didn't know what to do. I just couldn't stand my life anymore. And I called my daddy. He drove all night to get me, and he took me back to Millen, Georgia with me. And he said, Billy, I want you to see this psychiatrist. I said, Daddy, I have seen all these psychiatrists. None of them have been able to help me. My drinking had never come up. Nobody had ever told me I drank too much. And I'd already said I wasn't going to drink like my mother, and I didn't drink like my mother. I was not the type of drunk she was. But my daddy said, there's a famous psychiatrist in Augusta, Georgia, named Dr. Corbett Thigpen. All I remember is walking up the steps to go to his office. The next thing I knew, I had a suitcase, and I was walking between two double doors, and they clanged behind me, and they locked. Then they put me in this little cubbyhole of a room with a bed in it, and there was another girl in there, and that door locked too. They took away my cigarettes, my lighter. They took away my belts. They took away my shoelaces. Took away my razor and my razor blades and everything. And I was locked up in a mental institution. And I didn't know why I was there. The next morning, they came to get me. And they said, we've got to take you down to this little room. And I said, what are you going to do? And they said, take your shoes off and get up on this gurney. They wouldn't shoot the electricity to me. And I had numerous sessions of the wonderful electric shock treatments. And it got to the point that every morning I'd go in there and I'd look at, flip through the page, you'd find my name and see how many votes they were going to shoot to me that day. And I can't remember if I had 10 or 12 shock treatments, and they were consecutive days. And I would wake up in the morning, or rather come to, and I would be sitting in the cafeteria at the breakfast table eating breakfast, and I wouldn't know how I got there. And when I needed to take a bath or shower or whatever and shave my legs, one of the nurses had to stay in there with me, watching me use the razor blade. Because you know, back then they didn't have the disposable ones that you could use and throw away. And my memory started getting fuzzier and fuzzier. And a lot of this was filled in by my father. To this day, I cannot tell you what that doctor looked like. I cannot tell you what his diagnosis was. I don't ever remember talking to him. But I remember one morning I got up and I went to look to see how many votes they were going to shoot me. And they said, oh, you're not going to get any today. So it gave me an opportunity to look into this room with double doors to see these other people that had had theirs. Do y'all know what somebody looks like when they've had shock treatments? How reddish black they're looking, and they've got these tongue suppressors in their mouths so they don't swallow their tongues. And I thought, oh my God, that's the way I looked each time they gave me one. Well, I remember asking a nurse, when can I go home? And she said, soon. And a few days later, they came and told me, you're going home. And I got to thinking, I said, where's home? I couldn't remember. I had totally lost my memory. These two men came to pick me up. One of them was my husband and the other one was my brother. And when I refer to sisters and brothers, these are half-sisters and brothers. I had no holds. And I didn't know who these men were. They picked me up and I was terrified. They put me between them in the truck and they drove me back to Millen, Georgia. But for some odd reason, I remembered my daddy. I never forgot who my daddy was. And it was years later, my daddy pulled out a lot of letters. I had written him every day that I was in there, and he gave them to me to read. And each letter, the handwriting got worse and worse. And in each letter, I asked, why am I here? What happened? What did I do? And Daddy never would tell me what the doctor told him. I never knew. I never knew I had a drinking problem. And I got back to my daddy's house, and there was this beautiful little girl. And I asked who she was, and they said, "That's your daughter." And I didn't know who she was. That night, I went into hallucinations. I had been kept in such a sterile environment for weeks, and when I got out, and I guess the bacteria hit me, I started running 106 fever and started having delusions just like someone in DTs, and they had to put me in ice baths. And then when they got the fever down, my dad said, "She's sleeping with me tonight," and I did. Well, eventually, my husband took me home, and I got back to Mississippi. Nothing had changed. Nothing was better. And I went from being a weekend drinker to a daily drinker. Y'all got to understand, I could not live without the alcohol, but I didn't know that at the time. I absolutely didn't know it. And life rocked on. My mother had left her husband. She was back in Mississippi. My grandmother had called me. My mother was driving everybody crazy. And you would have to know my grandmother to realize this. You know, Catholics aren't supposed to be so superstitious. But when you come from the old country, you are superstitious. She believed in werewolves, you know, lock the doors and bar them on the full moon and all this kind of stuff. Well, anyway, my grandmother never knew how to drive. So she had this old black man, Ned. He was the taxi cab driver in Leland, Mississippi. And whenever she wanted to go anywhere, she'd get old Ned. Well, Ned told my grandmother about this witch doctor. This witch doctor, he was a black man. He lived out in the country in the fork of a road. And she said, "Billy, I want you to go visit this witch doctor, and I want you to talk to him and see if he can't get your mother to quit drinking." Now, y'all, here I am in the alcoholism, and I'm going to a witch doctor, and I'm going to get my mother to stop drinking. So Ned takes me to the witch doctor, and he says, "You wait here in the car." He sneaks in the back door and he talks to him and says, "You know, I've got this lady out here." And they sneak me into the back door and I get to talk to this witch doctor. Well, he wanted a lock of mother's hair and he wanted two other personal things of hers. And I don't remember what they were, but I managed to get these things. And I went back, and when I went back by myself. And so I parked and I went and knocked on the back door, you know, and he let me in and I gave him these things. And he says, "Now I am going to pray on the night of the full moon with my Bible. And these items that you have brought me, and she will not drink anymore." And would y'all believe when I asked him how much I owed him? He says, "Whatever you want to give me." And you know, I have a hard time remembering because this wasn't too very long after I'd had my shock treatments. I don't remember if I gave him a week's salary or a month's salary. Probably sounds more like I gave him a month's salary, you know, to do this. Well, let me tell y'all something. It didn't work. Mother got worse and worse and worse. It just didn't work. And you know, when my mother was drinking, she was one of these that blamed me for everything. I said, "Mother, I didn't ask to be brought in this world." She said, "Well, I had you and you got to take care of me. It's your responsibility to take care of me." I said, "But you never took care of me. But you're my flesh and blood and it's your responsibility to take care of me." My mother and I had a love-hate relationship for all my life. When she was sober, she was the most beautiful person inside. I loved her dearly. And when she was drunk, she was a monster. And there were many, many times I saw my mother go through DTs. I would come into the house and she would be hammering nails in the back door to keep the little green men out. Or we would be sitting on the couch and she'd say, "Isn't that music beautiful?" And I'd say, "What music, Mama?" And she said, "Oh, the music coming out of the lamp." you know, and I never hear the music. And it got to the point that I told my husband, when mother calls, I am no longer home. I cannot deal with that drunk. And here I am, a drunk. But I was handling it. I was a functioning drunk. By this point in my life, my husband and I owned our own business. We had a grocery store out in the country. And believe it or not, we bootlegged liquor. Guess what we had? Old Charter. You know, anybody wanted to come there and they wanted a half pint, we kept half pints. We didn't keep anything any bigger than that. And, of course, Bobby never could figure out why he had to go buy so many cases of half pints, you know, because I kept drinking them up. But life rocked on, and things just didn't get any better. And we got out of the grocery store, and I bought a retail shop. And I became this big financier, or whatever you want to call it, entrepreneur, or whatever. Manure was more like it. But anyway, I owned this business. And I had to go on these buying trips to Dallas and do all this other stuff. And let me tell you what, honey, I'd go out to Dallas on a buying trip, and I had two sets of clothes, one for Greenville, Mississippi, you know, and then this really good-looking, sexy set of clothes for Dallas. And I'd get out there, and I'd get all dressed up and go sit on a bar stool. Farrah Fawcett, watch out, because here I come. And I could be anybody I wanted to be, you know. Got to the point that I didn't know really what was true and what wasn't true, because I loved to be the actress. And, you know, they say we're great actor and actresses. And I also loved to be the director. I loved to control. And if I couldn't control you, I had no use for you. Men were very intimidated by me, and women hated me. And I did not have women friends. I liked the men. They were nicer. You know, women talk too much. I found out later men talk worse than women. But anyway, I came back home after one of these trips, and my life really went downhill extremely fast. I had gotten to the point where I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to answer the telephone. All I wanted to do was to sit in my rocking chair, and I wanted to drink. I had a recliner, rocker recliner in the den, and I would sit in it, and I would rock back and forth and back and forth. I wouldn't do anything but drink. And I would drink so much that I could actually hear the booze in my stomach swishing back and forth, just like waves on the ocean, because I wasn't going to eat anything. Lose that buzz? Couldn't eat anything. I'd go to bed at night, and I was so terrified that I would sleep with my back up to my husband, and I knew he'd have that side covered, and I could see up here and over here, because somebody was going to get me. I would get in the rocking chair in the bedroom, and I would rock back and forth, trying to will myself over the line to insanity. I knew I was insane. I had papers. I already knew I was nuts. So if I could will myself over the line to insanity, I'd still be alive. But I wouldn't know anything, and it wouldn't make any difference. Because, you see, I was raised this wonderful young Catholic girl, and I had gotten to the point where I hated God. I no longer trusted God, because everything I had asked God to do for me, He hadn't done. He never answered my prayers. And I knew that I was damned to hell. That was where I was going. There's no place else for Billy to go. And that's why I wanted to go insane, because I was too afraid to die. But I was more afraid to live. I couldn't live either. And this beautiful child that I had, I did everything in my power to destroy her. She was very shy, very awkward, very tall. She took after her daddy. Way taller than me. And I wanted her to be just like me. But thank God she didn't let me. It got to the point that she had met this young man and she wanted to get married. She was a freshman in college. And we said, okay. But then Joanne came down sick. And they diagnosed her. They kept bringing her home every weekend from school. She had flu-like symptoms, and they diagnosed her with Crohn's disease. Everything she ate came back up. Well, she was in the hospital for a week before they were ever able to diagnose her, and she was so weak that all she could do was lift one finger. And a radiologist sent me word through a cousin of mine that worked under him and said, get this child out of Greenville, Mississippi before they kill her. And I took her to Memphis, to Dr. McCoy. And in the old hospital there on Union Street, they had to operate on her and remove parts of her intestine because they had grown together. They were obstructed. And when this child was in the hospital, on the way going to the hospital, she gave me a verbal will as to who to leave her belongings to. She wanted this friend to have that and another friend to have something else. Now, y'all, I'm an alcoholic, and I couldn't cope with that. I had a truckload of whiskey in the car. And we got up there, and I got her situated in the room in the hospital. And her daddy hadn't come up there yet. And across a breezeway or something, there was a building with a couple of floors for motel rooms in it that was attached to the hospital. I went over there and put my supply in. And I wouldn't stay with her at night. I had to go back to drink to be able to cope. And then she had gotten so bad, and they didn't know if she was going to live. I took my whiskey to the room in the hospital, and I drank in the hospital and sat next to her. And, you know, you think this is your child and she may die any minute, that you'd be able to stay sober. I couldn't. I had to drink to get through that. Well, she survived the surgery, and she got out, and thank God she didn't have to have a colostomy. But the doctor told her that she would never be able to have children. And she married this boy after she told him everything, and he said, yes, I still want to marry you. And so they got married. Now, being the typical alcoholic that I am, my child had to have the biggest and the best wedding in the country. And we invited 600 people. She got married at the Catholic Church in Greenville. We had food at the wedding. We had a bar at the wedding. And, of course, my cousin owned a liquor store. So I went to the liquor store and I got all the booze. And you know how we think, you know, we better get double the order just to make sure we have enough. And I doubled the order, and we had the wedding, and everything was beautiful. And the day of the wedding, I got so nervous and so drunk, I couldn't go to her bridesmaid's luncheon. She had to go without me. I stayed home. And it was an evening wedding. And I made it to the wedding, and everything went fine. And of course, after the wedding, I started drinking really nicely. Y'all know it's so hard for a woman to be a lady and drink. You know, that's a lot of hard work. And I wanted to be a lady at all costs, but it's so hard. And after she had left to go on her honeymoon, I collapsed the cake. She had this beautiful wedding cake in the tiers under a gazebo with a champagne fountain in the center of it and these streamers coming off to little bitty cakes, side cakes from it. And somehow or another, I collapsed the whole darn thing. Cake went flying all over the floor and I broke the champagne fountain. So I had to immediately call the caterer and ask her to please make another top layer to go in the freezer. My daughter's marriage lasted 18 months. It was because she didn't get the original top layer. It was that other layer I had made. That's why our marriage didn't last. But anyway, the day, it was 2 days after the wedding because she got married on a Saturday. On Monday, my husband says, we have all this liquor left. And my husband says, aren't you going to take the booze back to the liquor store? Because they said we could return what was left. And I said, oh, honey, I will. So I got all the old charter, and I stacked it in the wall in my bedroom in the corner. So I get all the vodka and the gin and the scotch and champagne that was left, and I took it back. Did I get a credit? Swap it for old charter. So I bring home all these other cases. I don't know how many cases I finally wound up with, but it was stacked in my bedroom. Would you believe my husband never thought anything was odd about that? You know, that should tell you this person has got a problem. But anyway, I drank all those cases of booze. I drank them by myself. I never hid my booze, never got a DUI or anything like that. And I never claimed to having a blackout. I didn't claim to having a blackout until I was in the program 5 years. And I'd had numerous, numerous blackouts. Well, as I said, it was getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And I just couldn't make it anymore. So I decided I had to do something. I had gotten to be one of these nice crying drunks. And my husband would ask me, what is wrong? What do you want? And I would look at him and I'd tell him, I don't know what I want. Then I would scream, I want to be happy, but I don't know how. I thought people, places, and things could make me happy, and they couldn't. They just absolutely couldn't. So I thought, well, I knew there was a treatment center in Greenville, and this was January of 84. And I said, I'm going to make arrangements to go in this treatment center, and I'm going to get straightened out. And when I get straightened out, then I'll be able to drink normally. And the reason why I was going into this treatment center was because I had seen my mother have DTs too many times, and I did not want to be, you know, have DTs. And, you know, had no clue, though, that I was an alcoholic. Still did not think I was an alcoholic, that I was doing okay as far as the booze. The booze was my answer. It was not my problem. So I later found out that all the nurses and all of them took bets whether I would, you know, stay in the treatment center or not. Because I went on a Wednesday and I told them I needed to come in, but I couldn't come until Friday because I had to take care of my business and get everything right, you know, just right before I came into treatment. Well, I fooled them. I did show up. And believe it or not, I didn't get drunk the night before I went in. And I couldn't understand why I didn't do that. And I guess that was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I went into the treatment center and I told them, now I just want to be detoxed and then I'm going to get out. You know, they lie to you a lot in there to keep you in there. And I wound up staying 28 days. And I'm very grateful that I did. But one of the things they wanted us to do was to keep a feelings list. And let me tell you something. There were only two feelings I could identify. That was hate and anger. Those were the only two. And you see, by this point, I hated my great aunt and uncle that helped raise me. I hated my husband. I hated my mother. I hated everybody around me. And when I was in that rocking chair, rocking back and forth, drinking, I wished them all dead. I wanted everybody to die and leave me alone. And I didn't know any other feelings. I knew nothing about compassion, nothing about love. And I made up something to put down on these feelings list because I didn't know what I was feeling. One day they gave us a sheet of paper and they said, on one side, put down how you project yourself to other people, and on the other side, put down how you really are. And I started writing down, oh, I'm full of confidence, and I do this, blah, blah, and I do that, and everybody thinks I'm wonderful, and I'm so self-assured and all this stuff. And then when I got ready to write on the other side, I totally broke down because I was this insecure person that I wanted you to love me. And I did everything in my power to make you not love me. I made my husband's life a living hell. That man loved me more than anything in the world. And I never realized it because I didn't allow myself to. He never left me. He did everything he could to help me. And I kept giving him these things that he needed to do to prove that he loved me. And then it wasn't good enough, and I just couldn't believe anybody could ever love me when I wanted you to love me so much. Well, I broke down, and I went flying to my room when I started writing how I really was and how scared I was and how frightened. And it was devastating for me to find out that I was really that way. And this old black nurse that had been taking care of us put her arms around me, and I rested my head on her bosom. And I cried and I cried, and she held me and she held me. And she says, it's going to be all right. And that night I laid in bed and I kept saying the Serenity Prayer over and over and over again. And I said, God, if you really want to take me, take me. Because if something doesn't happen, I can't live like this anymore. The next morning I woke up and I was still alive. I couldn't believe it. And it was like God was telling me he was giving me a second chance. And I began to decide that I wanted to be sober and I wanted this life. Well, they took us to an outside meeting. It's the first AA meeting I'd ever been to. Now, mind you, my mother had been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. It never took. And I vaguely knew a little bit of something about it. But I still didn't think that alcohol was my problem. Alcohol was my solution. And when I went to this meeting, there were no women in treatment when I was in treatment, by the way. It was all men. I could not relate to a lot of them. When I went to this meeting, a woman was sharing. And she says, we're going to do something a little bit different tonight. She says, I want everybody to go around and tell a little bit about yourselves, how you drank, and how you got in here, just real quickly. And there were several ladies in the meeting. And the woman that shared drank just like I did. I was not a bar drinker. I was a home drinker. The only time I ever drank in a bar was when I was out with my husband or I was in Dallas trying to be Miss Whoever. And I thought to myself, I drank like that. But then I never lost my family. I never lost a job. Never got a DUI. But she didn't either. And all of a sudden, this light bulb went off in my head. And I thought, I'm an alcoholic. When these people started talking about what was wrong with them, I understood them. For the first time in my life, I understood a group of people talking and knew what they were talking about. And when I talked, they honestly understood how I felt. And that had never happened to me before in my life. I just didn't know. All the psychiatrists and the money I wasted with them, they never helped me. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous told me what was wrong with me. I was an alcoholic. I had all the isms. I had the personality. I had everything. And I want you to know, I wanted what you had. I love the sparkle in the eyes. I love the laughter. Because my laughter before had always been forced. It was never from really deep inside me. And I wanted what you had. I wished I could tell y'all that life was beautiful and everything was wonderful and everything was okay after that, but it wasn't. As much as I wanted the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I fought it just as hard. I looked up those steps and I thought to myself, there's no way I'm going to tell anybody what I've done. In treatment, they said, oh, Billy, you're a Catholic. You're used to going to confession. This should be a breeze for you. I said, do you think I ever told the priest the truth? You know, they wouldn't let you out of treatment until you did a fourth and fifth step. That is so ridiculous. What do you know when you're a few weeks sober? You know, how can you do a fourth step when you're a few weeks sober? So I didn't know what to do. And they get this young intern that's going to become a minister, and they send me in there to talk to him. And I went in there, and all I knew to tell him was my life story. Poor, pitiful Billy. When I got through, this young man had tears streaming down his face. He put his arms around me. He started patting me on the back. He said, my God, Billy, you deserve to drink. I would have drank, too, if I had a life like yours. Well, y'all, that's what I wanted to hear. You know, and I'm going to try to speed this up a little bit for you. Anybody new in here, please do your fourth and fifth step with a sponsor. I highly recommend it. Because if you do it with somebody that doesn't know anything about the program, you're not doing yourself any favors. And give yourself a little time in the program before you do it. Regain a little bit of sanity so that you know what you're doing. So get some guidance. Well, anyway, needless to say, that was not a real fourth and fifth step, and I had to do another one in the program much later. But I got out of treatment. And I wanted what you wanted, what you had, but I couldn't do the steps. Y'all were asking me to admit I was powerless. I got the first part of step one, but I didn't think my life was unmanageable. My God, I was been in a nut house and everything else and crazy. My life wasn't unmanageable, but it was. It took me a long time to realize that. And it said, restore you to sanity. I thought, well, now I need that one because I was already certified. And one of the old timers told me, he said, he could restore you to sanity, not that he would. So that kind of bothered me a little bit. And then they wanted me to turn my will and my life over to care of God, as I understood him, make a decision too. This God that I knew didn't love me. I didn't trust this God. He never answered my prayers. He never did anything for me. And I couldn't do that. And step four, tell somebody what I'd done. Let me tell y'all something. I was a genius when I came in this program. I knew everything. I wasn't going to tell you anything. I wasn't going to tell you a thing, let alone the truth. I couldn't, because if I told you, you'd hate my guts. Get rid of my character defects. Let me tell you something. My character defects were my defense mechanism. That wall went up, and honey, I got you before you got me. I plotted more deaths, more murders than anybody you could ever possibly think of. I had field days with these daydreams and thinking, well, I'll get even with you, and honey, I can wait. I'll get you one of these days. When it came time for me really to do my fourth and fifth step, I didn't know what was true and what wasn't true. I was that messed up because I had played so many roles. And I was terrified, absolutely terrified, to find out who the real Billy was, because I didn't know. Even into sobriety and everybody trying to help me with this program, my life was still miserable. I was thrown into service work almost immediately when I got into this program. And when I took through the ranks and became delegate of Mississippi. But even during all of this, I still had so many flaws, character defects, and everything. And let me tell you what, if you've got a problem with ego or need to learn a little humility, get in service work and let those old timers take care of you, because, honey, they'll knock you down in a minute. Let me tell you. They'll tell you, shut up, you don't know anything. And I really learned a lot. Patience, tolerance, humility, you know, get rid of the ego and that Delta pride. But there was still something missing in my life. I still had the fear, and things still weren't right. I could practice the program with members and other people, but I couldn't practice the program at home with my husband. And at the end of 13 months of sobriety, a so-called tragedy happened. At least I thought it was a tragic enough event for me to drink again. And I took a drink. And I thought nobody would blame me. Do you know nobody knew I had that first drink in my hand at the house? I drank it, and I was on my second drink before my husband even knew I had a drink. And then I poured the third drink, and halfway through the third drink, all the fear, everything came flooding back in like it had never, ever left. It was terrifying. And I thought, no, I do not want to go back to this. I felt like a python had just wrapped around my body and was just squeezing the life out of me. And I found out then, Billy, you are your own worst enemy. And I had had people tell me in the program until I found a higher power that I wasn't going to make it. I poured that drink out. And I didn't want to go back to AA and tell those people that I had drank again. Because by this time I was Miss AA. I knew everything. You know, I told you what you wanted to hear, not what I really needed to say. And I had so much darn pride that, you know, I wouldn't pick up another chip for 5 years. It took me that long. I'm going to speed this up a little bit now. I still could not completely trust God. I still couldn't turn my life over to Him. It took me a long, long time. First, I had to trust the program that it was going to work. then I had to learn how to begin to trust people. Because you see, no person had ever lived up to my expectations. You always disappointed me. So, therefore, I didn't trust people. I always had to do things myself. Shortly after I was in the program, this father of mine that I dearly loved became very sick. He had to have a bypass surgery. And I went to Georgia to be with him. And my stepmother said everything was fine. I said, Daddy, tell the doctors how much he drank. She said, yes, he took care of that. I later found out he told him that he drank, but he could handle his drinking. And my daddy was a daily drinker, but he was a functioning alcoholic. They did the surgery on him, and he did beautifully that afternoon. The next day, my daddy went into DTs, and he went in a coma. And then my family turned on me because I was the alcoholic in the family, and I should have said something. So it was my fault that my father was in there in a coma. Let me tell you something. The people in Augusta, Georgia, in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, loved me through that period. I called them, and they had meetings right there in the hospital. And you're not going to believe this. One of the meetings was outside of that hospital, another building, and it was the very building that I had been in the nut ward. Talk about bring back old memories. But these people loved me. They took me home with them to have a cup of coffee. But they would always bring me back, and I lived out of the trunk of my car and slept on the couch in the waiting room for 4 weeks. My daddy's kidneys gave way, and my daddy was allergic to morphine, and that's what they gave him was morphine. And he had begged them never give him morphine if something happened, but they did. And his kidneys started failing, and they said he's never going to come out of the coma. So I never had a chance to tell my daddy in person goodbye and how much I loved him. But his body began stinking, and they would roll in the portable dialysis machine in there to him. And my stepmother and my brother and mother's sisters had gotten to the point where they couldn't stay with him anymore. And I said, there's no hope for Daddy. He is no longer alive. And I said, y'all have got to cut the machines off. And they said, no, we can't. I said, Daddy wants these machines cut off. I said, cut them off. And they took the machines off of him, and I stayed in there with my daddy, and I never left his side. It was February the 18th, and that was my daughter's birthday. And I did not want my daddy to die on my daughter's birthday. For her to carry that through the rest of her life. So they had disconnected Daddy, and it was 10 o'clock that night. And I was talking to him, and I had a wet cloth, and I was sponging the crystals that had formed on his body because he had needed the dialysis so bad. And I talked to him, and I said, Daddy, please don't go. Don't go yet. Today's the 18th, and it's Joanne's birthday. Please don't go. At 1 minute after 12 that night, I put my arms around Daddy and I said, Daddy, it's after 12 o'clock. I said, if you want to go now, you can. See, they told me my daddy couldn't hear me. And my daddy died in my arms. I love my daddy very much. Shortly after my daddy died, this aunt and uncle that helped raise me died. They died within 3 weeks of each other. Uncle Joe was 96 and my aunt was 86. And shortly after that, my mother died. My mother died in January during an ice storm. I had my business and I was in Greenville and kept trying to call her and get her on the telephone. And there was no answer. And I called my husband. I said, honey, something's wrong. I can't get mother. The line has been busy for 2 days.
And I said, I want to go to Leland to see about her. It took me 45 minutes to drive 7 miles. And I finally got to the house and I couldn't get in, and I had my key to the house, but the deadbolt was locked, and the chain was locked. And I called the police, and they got there, and they had these snippers to slip through the door to cut the chains. And we went back to her bedroom, and she had locked herself in the bedroom. And they busted the door, and my mother was on the floor. She had been on a bender, and there were empty fists around her. And she had had a stroke. She was alive, but her body temperature had dropped down to the temperature that was in that room, and it was 78 degrees in that room. And that's what her body temperature had dropped to. And I rode with her in the ambulance to the hospital. And she had two children, two girls and a boy, by her second marriage, and I got in touch with them and told them. And they came. But my mother died before they got there, and she died in my arms. You know, it wasn't until I was in the program quite a while that I realized that I could forgive my mother, because she was an alcoholic. She was just like me. And I didn't understand the things that she did when I was a child growing up. And I realized as an adult, growing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that she couldn't help a lot of the things that she did. And I was able to forgive her. I was able to forgive my father. But y'all, these were the people that I loved, had love-hate relationships with, and everybody was dying. And I felt like it was my fault because I had wished them all to die and leave me alone so I could get on with my life. I still could not put my trust in God. I just couldn't take step 3. I went ahead and took step 4 and step 5. But I couldn't take step 3. I could make the decision, but I couldn't carry through with it. And I could not get rid of my character defects. I could not ask God to remove them because they were still my defense mechanism. And I didn't want you to hurt me. I'd been hurt enough. And then I'd been in the program quite a while, and my husband came down with leukemia. And this was a man that I had never truly loved, or I guess I loved as much as I was capable of ever loving a human being. Man that had stuck by me and was wonderful. And he came down with leukemia. And we went to MD Anderson, and we had to live out there. And my youngest brother from my mother's marriage was a doctor out there. And we lived in his garage apartment while he took experimental chemo and everything else that they could possibly give him. He even did a mini bone marrow transplant on him. And I knew he wasn't going to live. But I had 6 months with him to make amends, because you see, right before we went to Houston, I left him. I left him. And then I came back to him because I couldn't do it to him. And during that 6 months, God gave him to me so that I could let him know that I love him and that I was sorry, that even in the years of sobriety that I had, that I still could not be the wife that he deserved or needed or wanted. As Bobby got sicker, our daughter and her children came out. And Bobby developed double pneumonia, and he'd already developed graft versus host disease, even though his brother and he were a total match. He still developed graft versus host disease, and he came down with double pneumonia, and he was also hemorrhaging inside because he had no platelets. They had to give him daily platelets for 6 months. He had gone into a coma, and I was sitting there with my head on the bed at 2 o'clock in the morning, this English nurse came in and she said, "Billy." By this time, everybody's on first name basis is out there. And she said, "Billy, why don't we scoot him over and you get in the bed with him?" I said, "Okay." And we scooted him over and adjusted his oxygen and everything. And I crawled in the bed with him. And I got to sleep 4 hours in his arms. And it was the best thing that had happened to me. And it was the best sleep that I had had in a long, long time. The next morning, I asked the nurse, I said, "How long can he go on like this?" And she said, "Billy, have you given him permission to die yet?" And I said, "No." And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "You need to tell him it's okay." I sent everybody out of the room then, and I crawled back in bed with him, and I put my arms around him, and I told him, I said, "Bobby, I love you." I said, "Joanne and I will be okay, and I understand if you have to go." And within minutes, his breathing changed, and he died in my arms. It was during that point in time that I finally, and this was in 96, that I finally was able to accept God in my life. Because you see, it was during this time that Bobby was so ill that I found out that I was ill. And they diagnosed me with an incurable muscle disease and told me I had 5 years to live. And I had gotten to the point that I couldn't walk, and I was ready for a wheelchair. And I so desperately one day wanted to get on my knees and pray. And I said, "God, if you please help me get on my knees. And help me to get up, because I couldn't get up without help." And I said, "It's just you and me." And I got on my knees and I prayed. And I got up just like that. I didn't need any help getting up. I knew then that God was with me, that God had always been with me. That's why I love this. The poem, Footprints in the Stands. Because God carried me all the years since I had been born. He let me live for a reason. I still don't know what that reason is. But he let me stay on this earth. That Christmas after Bobby died, and I came back. Of course, everybody in the program was around me, and they stayed with me, and they loved me. But I had decided I couldn't live anymore. And it was the night of my AA Christmas party in my home group in Leland. And I had charge of the meat. And I had decided that I didn't want to live anymore. And I went out and bought 3/5 of O Charter. And I got the gun, and I put a bullet in it. And I was going to drink enough till I got up the courage to kill myself. And I want to tell you how God works. God did not want me to die. He instead made sure that I could not reach anybody by telephone to ask them to please come get the meat for the meeting. Couldn't find a soul at home. And I figured, well, I cannot disappoint my group because I loved everybody in that group. And I said, "Okay, I'll take a bath, I'll get dressed, I'll go drop off the meat, and then I'll sneak out." And I did. The minute I walked into that room, Darla B., one of my dearest, dearest friends in the program, and she became delegate after I did, or a couple of panels after I did. And she grabbed me and she said, Billy, something's wrong. What's wrong? I said, nothing. I said, I just don't feel good. I'm just going to leave the meeting. I'm going to go home. And she says, no, you're not. You're staying. And they made me stay and eat and listen to the speaker. And then she still wouldn't let me leave. She made me sit there and talk to her after that Christmas party. And by the time I got home, I didn't want to kill myself anymore. And I poured the booze out. I took the bullet out of the gun. And I made a big decision that what I needed to do was to move to Oxford, Mississippi, to be near my grandchildren, whom I loved very, very much, and these grandchildren had never seen me drunk. And I never did ruin my daughter. She forgave me for everything I ever did to her. And today she's my best friend. I love her dearly and she loves me. God has done wonders for me. You know, if Billy gets out of the way, Billy quits trying to control. If Billy had only trusted, and I couldn't. God brought me to Oxford, Mississippi, and you know, alcoholics don't like change. I was terrified to move from the place I'd known all my life. And I got to really know my grandchildren and my daughter. And I thought, I will never, ever, ever fall in love and get married again. But let me tell you something. You people in this program finally taught me how to love. You taught me what the meaning of love was. Unconditional love. And someone introduced me to this wonderful man up here on the front row, Jim. And he has been the light of my life. God, for some reason, has finally given me everything I've ever wanted in my life, in my later years in life. Everything. Today, I do not want for anything. In the past, I never wanted to be where I was. I always lived in yesterday or tomorrow. Today, I've learned to finally live in today. Today, I finally learned how to give back. And I learned that the more I give, the more I receive. Today, I have true friends that I thought I would never, ever have. And that's each and every one of you in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I may not know your name, but honey, believe me, I know you. You know, it gave me the chance to make amends to all of these people that I had hurt so desperately. You know, I had an old-timer tell me one time, said, "Dadgummit, Billy, you did all those things. You're guilty now. Get over it and move on with your life. Live with it and try to change and show these people you change." That's what this program is about. You know, you can't say, "I'm sorry." You got to live it. You got to walk this program. And you got to talk this program. And with Jim, I've been able to do that. This is a man that understands me. He's in the program. And believe me, if I start losing my program, he lets me know real quick. But I'm very happy with him. God can do this for me. I owe everything to him today. And I look back at myself and I said, "Billy, why were you so hard-headed? Why did it take you so long to surrender?" See, folks, there's the secret. Surrender. It's only through surrendering that we can live a happy, joyous, and free life. It's only through giving that we can receive. Today, I can honestly look in the mirror and say, Billy, I love you. I can honestly look in the mirror and say, I know who you are. And I like me today. And I never could say that before. If there's anybody left in this room this morning, I know y'all are getting tired of me. If you haven't been in the program long, let me tell you something. You have absolutely nothing to lose. But you have got a beautiful journey ahead of you, a beautiful life ahead of you. If you just stick around, and it took me a lot of years of sticking around till I finally got it. This hard head finally opened up, and I finally let God in, the higher power and acceptance. And surrender were the secrets for me. And thank y'all so much. I have enjoyed this so much. Thank you for inviting me.